You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 91. Follow your bliss, and the universe will open doors for you where there was once walls. Joseph Campbell.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft. It's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari.
Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com.
Now, guys, today on the show, we have author and story analyst Chris Vogler. And Chris is the author of The Writer's Journey: Mythic Structure for Writers. And his book is based on Joseph Campbell's monomyth and the hero's journey, which is responsible for pretty much every big major blockbuster since Star Wars came out in the 70s. But elements of the monomyth or the hero's journey has been in our stories since the beginning of time. And that is the genius of Joseph Campbell and what he was able to do with his book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces. Now, Chris was able to take Joseph Campbell's work and apply it to the movie business because he was a story analyst working in the studio system, and he is responsible for working on some of the most successful films during the resurgence of Disney animation, like The Lion King, Aladdin, Little Mermaid, and so on. And I know a lot of screenwriters and storytellers think that the monomyth is over, it's dead, everybody knows it now, why would you use it? I mean, the story of Star Wars is such a classic representation of the hero's journey, but everyone's seen that story. It's stale, it's old now. The audience, it really doesn't surprise the audience anymore. Well, the thing is that the hero's journey or the monomyth is the basis. It's like understanding how to use flour in baking. Now, we all need to understand the principles of flour if you're going to be a baker, but what you do with that flour is what makes you unique as a pastry chef. So the same principles apply in story. So understanding the hero's journey or the monomyth is imperative for all screenwriters. Now, Chris and I get into it in regards to the monomyth and how you can apply it in today's world and little tricks that you could use to make the monomyth fresh and unique in your stories. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Chris Vogler. I'd like to welcome back to the show, returning champion, the legendary Chris Vogler. How are you doing, Chris?
I'm doing very well. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming back. Last time you were on the show, which was about 3 years ago, I think at this point, I said to you many times then, and I'll say it again, when I picked up The Writer's Journey as a young screenwriter, filmmaker, it completely changed my life. And it was my gateway drug into Campbell, in general, which I'm sure you hear a thousand times. It was my gateway drug. And it really, really just changed the way I looked at storytelling. And it is a foundation that every screenwriter and storyteller should know. Whether they use it specifically or not, whether it applies to every single story or not, it's definitely one of the building blocks of a good story. So I am a huge fan, and now you're back because you're just releasing the 25th year edition, the anniversary edition of The Writer's Journey, and we're going to talk a little bit about the book, the updates, how the hero's journey has changed. It's changed that all over the years and so on. So for people who don't know who you are, can you tell us a little bit about you and the book?
Yes, I made a career for myself in Hollywood as what they call a story analyst at first, reading scripts and writing reports, evaluating not just scripts, but every kind of literary property, even down to cartoons, comic books, epic poems from the ancient past. I mean, you have an army of people like me at every studio who are evaluating the material. So this was how I sort of cut my teeth and got a lot of examples under my belt to compare to this hero's journey idea that I had come up with in film school at the USC. You know, as a kid, I was absolutely transfixed by movies and certain TV shows. And I just wanted to pull the screen apart and climb in there. You know, I had this desire to be part of it. Growing up in the Midwest, it was a remote possibility for me as a farm boy from Missouri. But I found my way there and got involved in the studios and was lucky to find an answer to my question. I came on a quest to figure out the unwritten rules of screenwriting. I knew there had to be some principles, what we would now call algorithms, for how do you decide what to put in, what to leave out, what to emphasize, how to blend all this together. I was looking for that system, and there wasn't anything. There were very few screenwriting books at that time, and I was lucky to find it in the work of this man, Joseph Campbell, who was a big influence on Star Wars and George Lucas and many other films and books since then. And it just hit exactly the right note for me at the right time when the first Star Wars movie came out. So I had the collision of those two things in my brain. Here's Joseph Campbell's ideas about this ancient form from mythology, and here's a modern cutting-edge technology entertainment that's making use of all that stuff. So the two things slapped together in my head at the right moment. And then I had a long period of time working for the studios to test it out on thousands, literally thousands and thousands of examples, and found it to be really a lifesaver. I don't know how I would have done that job without some orientation about what makes a story interesting and gripping to an audience, and how does it hook you, and all these other things that you get from looking at mythology.
Great. And I remember there was a memo, that a very famous memo, that kind of brought you to the forefront when you were working over at Disney, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
Yeah, that's right. I started at Fox, worked there for a couple of years, and then switched over to Disney. And I've been working there for a while, just doing the routine job, but I was getting a little bit more attention within the company and a little bit more responsibility because they knew I was good at pop culture things like comic books. I was good at general research, so they could throw things at me and I could respond quickly and give them an answer. I was like Google before there was Google. But we were in a culture at the studio at that time where memos were big, and they were being very well written by the head of production at that time, Jeffrey Katzenberg. He would just throw down a memo, and it would like shake everybody up and give a completely different perspective on how we were going to operate. So I turned this idea from Campbell into a nice, tight little 7-8-page memo that I sent around the studio with an intention. And I think this was important. I intended for that thing to work like nanobots, like little robots that would go and spread my message around and get people talking about this hero's journey idea, which I thought was, it's not theoretical. It's not academic, really. It's practical and useful. And like right now, we can put this to work on commercial films, and not just adventure films and fantasy films, but it worked for me for everything. So that memo spread around Hollywood very quickly. It went viral, again, before the technology that we now have. This was faxes and Xerox machines, but it spread all over. And I got feedback right away from people saying, oh, it was mentioned at the top meeting at Paramount the other day, or somebody over at Sony said, hey, have you read this memo? So it became the flavor of the month for a while. And I watched to see, is that going to last or will it be a flash in the pan? And it ended up sticking. You know, it was something that made sense. It was simple. It was clear. And the memo did its job. And then eventually I added to it. But part of the legend, and this is about branding yourself, which I think everybody has to do. You have to think this way. How do you distinguish your work from all the other people who are doing similar things? My brand was, I am associated with this material, Campbell, Lucas, Star Wars, Disney. Eventually I worked on The Lion King because of it. But part of the branding legend is the true fact that the memo was plagiarized almost immediately. Some executive at Disney tore the cover sheet off with my name on it and put his own cover on it with his name and submitted it to the highest levels of the company. And there was a big thing about, oh my gosh, this is an amazing system in a way.
But he could, but you couldn't get away with that. I mean, like everybody else in town saw that it was yours. Like,
well, this was the value of spreading it, because I had salted it around so thoroughly that as soon as it came up in the meeting, people, they left the meeting and immediately started calling me and saying, hey, this guy's taking credit for your work. So I did something that was way out of character for me, because as a reader, you're generally passive and you sort of operate on a doggy door approach where you, they slide the script through the door and you slide the report back again.
Like a prison, sir, like a prison.
Yeah. You never see them except maybe the tips of their shoes. You know, you don't really deal with the brass. But I stepped out of that just a little bit, and I wrote a letter directly to Katzenberg over the heads of many department chiefs in between. I jumped the track there. And to my amazement, he responded immediately. He said, I know what happened. I got it. I see you're the guy who wrote this, and I have something for you, because I had asked. I said, I want something. I want more. If you think this is good, I've got plenty more, and I want deeper involvement in the company. And he said, yes, I see that, and I think where you belong is over with the animation guys, because they were just ramping up. They had done they were working on Aladdin and on Beauty and the Beast and so forth, and they threw me in on Lion King, which
not a bad film to get thrown in.
Not a bad start, although nobody knew that at the time. I mean, sure. This was kind of an amusing thing. They we really thought of ourselves as the B team, you know, because the bigger productions we thought were you know, further along, and we were just this little experimental thing that was something a little bit different, in part because it was based on no pre-existing thing. It was an original creation, and almost everything Disney does is based on some legend or myth, although there were things in it like a little bit of Hamlet, a little bit of Bambi, that gave it some support.
Right. And I have to ask you, there was that one Japanese animation movie that everyone brings up with Lion King. Is that, I mean, you were there. Is that real? Like, I don't know if you could say it, or the mouse come and get you.
No, I don't think anybody's going to police me about it. I was not aware of that myself, but mm-hmm. I did hear the animators talking about it, saying, isn't it an interesting coincidence that we picked up this thread of lions in Africa and we started working on it, and we ended up developing something. You could put the two things side by side and go, oh yeah, here's Kimba, here's Simba. And, you know, there were these similarities, and animators love this. They love paying homage, they say. To other filmmakers. They put in jokes and references. I worked on a Japanese style comic book, a manga comic book, and I was just amazed by how many times they inserted salutes, really, to other artists and other comic books. So It was just part of the culture there. But I don't feel, I didn't see any signs of deliberately, you know, ripping anybody off. But that's not a matter for us. It's for the courts to decide.
Exactly. Now, so you jumped in at Lion King, and I think this is during the Renaissance. Katzenberg brought in the Renaissance, the animation Renaissance, because Disney animation was pretty much in the doghouse for a while. It had been a long time since any majorly hit, big hit, had come out, and I think it started with Little Mermaid.
Yes.
And then jumped to, and then Beauty and the Beast was a monster hit. Then Aladdin came out. And I think, was Aladdin before? Aladdin was before Lion King, right?
Yes, it was. Yes.
Right. So, but then Lion King exploded. And then I think that was the peak of that renaissance. And then there were still a lot of good movies after as well. A lot of, if you go back to Disney animation, you can apply the hero's journey to it. And you can apply the hero's journey to a lot of movies pre-Star Wars.
Sure.
How is that? No one really was taking the hero's journey blueprint and going, okay, this is how I write the screenplay. But yet, when you go back to Casablanca, when you go back to Citizen Kane, you go back to Hitchcock films, there are hero's journey elements in those. How is it, just because it's literally programmed inside of our DNA?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's hardwired. It's baked into the human nervous system. This is what Campbell said. He said that we are wired to respond to certain scenes and images and ideas, and we respond in the organs of our body unconsciously. They just respond. When you see a fireman carrying somebody out of a fire, or a mother holding a baby, cradling the baby in a triangular composition like those Virgin Mary things and Isis holding the baby in the Egyptian mythology, you just go, ah, you respond. You see an animal with big eyes looking up at you, you go, ah. You can't help these physiological.
Yeah, I mean, you look at Puss in Boots in Shrek, and you just go like, ah. It's like you can't, like, it's a feeling inside you. You can't, even if your heart is a rock, you go inside, that's cute.
Yeah, I thought it was brilliant, really, that they made use of that. All that cat does is turn and look at you, and the eyes get huge, and you go, ah, you can't, you whatever he's just done, you forgive him. You feel sorry for him.
So Campbell is tapping into these images and these kind of scenarios that are hardwired. Like you said, if someone's saving somebody else, you're going to feel something in real life or in a film or in a story. If someone kicks the dog, that is a specific feel. Like if you're hurting an animal, if you're hurting a child, if you're hurting someone that's weaker than you, instinctively in our core, we generally feel the same. We all feel it, unless you're a bully too and you go, hey, that's great that you kicked the dog. But generally speaking, normal human beings have those innate feelings. And I think what you're saying in the writer's journey, as well as what Joseph Campbell was saying, is that if you can tap into those images, that kind of storytelling, and incorporate it in your films, in your scripts, you're just tapping into something that is universal.
Yes, I think, you know, the answer to your general question here has to do also with levels of consciousness. I think that the hero's journey was present and operative in filmmakers and storytellers from the very beginning. I mean, you go back to the Odyssey and to Gilgamesh, and, you know, the earliest things written are going to, you can open them up and you find there's that, this, that, and the other element of the hero's journey. But people were not openly conscious of it. And I think that's the difference of the time we're living in, that because partly my book and Campbell and the notoriety and notice that those things have gotten has moved these patterns up into consciousness a little bit more. So that even the audience is aware of them as meta patterns, and they kind of have what's turned out is that people have a certain pleasure in finding them and going, oh, yeah, I know that. That's the thing they did in Star Wars, or that's the thing they did in Superman. And there it is again, that people like to spot those patterns. So all of that, even the language of it, has come up more into consciousness. And for me, that's actually a bit of a danger, because I don't want it to be completely conscious. I don't want the audience going, oh yeah, step 13. Oh yeah, there's the blah, blah. I don't want them thinking that. And I don't even want that when I'm watching something. I get a certain workman's pleasure in identifying step 1, 2, 3 and you know, saying, oh, they're 3 minutes late on revealing something. But what's really fun for me is going to the movies and having no idea what's going to happen next and not knowing what's happening internally to my organs of my body. Just responding is wonderful. And then I might go back later and analyze it. But I like to be just swept away by a story that's unpredictable and, looks maybe looks rough when you analyze it by these standards. But it still can sing to you.
Isn't it? I mean, it's so much tougher to be a writer today than it was 5 years ago or 10 years ago or 20 years ago or 50 years ago, because the audiences are so much more educated in the process. I mean, in the 80s, when I was coming up, you know, and when I was working in my video store, I couldn't find behind the scenes of movies. There was no DVD extras. There was no YouTube. There was nothing. So the information about the filmmaking process, let alone the storytelling process, there was just nothing there. But now you could just go on YouTube and find 1,000 different, you know, people talking about the hero's journey or the or multiple different storytelling techniques and things like that. People have become so much more educated about the process. How do you suggest screenwriters work within that world, because it is so much more difficult to do it. I mean, my feeling is that if you can execute the hero's journey perfectly, really well, it doesn't matter. That's my feeling. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I think the key to all of this is to be aware that the audience does know a lot. They are very well educated, as you say. But you can still work with that and sometimes set them up, you know, to, okay, I'm going to show you, here's a wizard, all right? And the wizard is nice, and he or she is going to help the hero, and they're going to give the hero, all this is doctrine according to the hero's journey. And then reveal, not what you thought. This person who seems to be helpful is actually working for the bad guys, trying to undermine the hero, jealous of the hero, you know, some other unexpected twist, so that it's always new again. And this is what I tell people, is you are obligated as a filmmaker to know this set of instructions or patterns, this and many others. This is not the only one. In my own work, I don't exclusively use the hero's journey. There's lots of other ways to do this. But, you know, to know the patterns and then deliberately break them somehow. Do something unexpected. Do something that jumps out of the pattern, like, you know, referring to the mentor figures that I'm talking about. The pattern sort of predicts that somewhere in the first act, one of these figures is going to show up, reassure the hero when he or she is afraid, give them something that helps them, and then they're wheeled off, and that's the end of it. But what if there isn't any figure like that, and the hero is completely on his or her own, and they have to go to internal sources? That's a different kind of dynamic, and it leaves a hole sometimes. That's one of the key ways to make this fresh and alive again, I think, is to leave some gaps. There's a wonderful thing that I see filmmakers doing, which I'm very interested in this, which is sort of narrative compression, where they take it for granted. The audience is quick and they can catch up, and you can throw stuff in a series. You can start, and I've seen this on Schitt's Creek, for example. Schitt's Creek will sometimes start bang deep in the middle of something, and you go, did I miss an episode? Because now they're talking about maybe the parents are, I'm just making this up, but maybe the parents are talking about getting a divorce. And it starts with the son and daughter going, oh, I'm really worried. Mom and dad are talking about getting a divorce. And you go, what? I didn't see that. Did I miss an episode? And then you realize, no, they're trusting you as an audience, that you can catch up. And you can imagine those scenes that they left out. And I think that's a healthy way to approach things, is to kind of push to the edge of what the audience can keep up with, and throw them some curveballs sometimes.
Now, this is my feeling. I'd love to hear what you think. The reason why the hero's journey has been so long lasting in our existence, I mean, it's going back to as the oldest stories ever written or recorded. It is basically an analogy for our own lives. It is, you know, we are all on our hero's journey. We are always everyone, no matter if you're the good guy or the bad guy, you are the hero of your own journey. I always like people like, Hitler didn't wake up thinking that he was the craziest madman in the world. He thought he was good. He thought he was the hero. So everyone has a perspective. So we're all heroes in our own journey. And there are the tricksters, the mentors, the all these character archetypes that come into our lives, and there are obstacles, and we have our own dragons, and we have our own things, sometimes internal, sometimes external, all these things. Is that, do you think, the reason why the hero's journey has lasted in our existence for so long?
Yeah, I think so. I think that it's a useful metaphor. It's one way to look at it, is it's a kind of a lens that allows us to look at somebody else's situation, but read it back as reflective of us. And I think this is a real deep thing, that people are looking for themselves in their entertainment. They want to see something that in some sense is about me, because people are profoundly self-centered and they want to take in everything around them. Somebody walks into a room and they're dressed a certain way. You can't help it. You compare yourself to them. Oh, she has better shoes than I do. Oh, they just got their haircut. Oh, they have a nice bag. Oh, you measure all this stuff, and you just do it unconsciously. It's like a mathematical formula that runs through your head. So we compare our behavior to that of other people. And what I've observed is, if you are not hooked up to those characters in some way, either they're like me, or their plight is something I can relate to, or they desperately want something as I desperately want things, then I just check out and I back away, almost literally back away from the screen. I've learned a lot from watching audiences and how when they're involved in the picture, they're more or less absolutely still and they're leaning forward. And if they are bored and detached, they start shifting around and they back away. I think this is part of the key, is to give people things in the characters that you want us to relate to that a lot of people can identify with, that they are the victims of misfortune, undeserved, that they are striving for something, wanting something. A good example is there's this new show just coming out called Emily in Paris.
Yeah, I heard about that. I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah. And it's a beautiful show. It's lush. It's gorgeous. It's, superficial, beautiful salute to Paris and, young ambition and so forth. But in every show, every new show that I look at, I'm trying to decide, am I in this for the long run, or am I going to let it go after one or two episodes? And with that one, I had very little impulse to continue, because they didn't do one essential thing in the first episode, which is tell me what that character wants. Yeah, she didn't want anything. She was given a trip to Paris, and she never expressed a desire to travel, a desire to go to Paris, a desire to, we never saw her ambition to rise in the company. She just was like flooded with these gifts from heaven and is walking around in awe about Paris. And you could guess that she had the general desire of every young person to succeed or to have an adventure. But she never said it. It wasn't expressed. Nobody around her said it. So I found myself not really involved. So I think this is important to let people know what does a character want. As soon as I know what they want, I want it for them, and I have now almost merged my personality with theirs. Even if it's a villain and the villain is trying to undermine society, I'm kind of going, oh, he almost lost his chance to undermine society. You automatically plug in.
Now, a lot of the concepts that you talk about in The Writer's Journey and Campbell talks about in The Hero's Journey are very, broad, meaning that the hero, like, let's take, you identify with Luke Skywalker because, of all the things that Luke Skywalker wants to do and things like that. So it's, and it basically appeals to a very broad audience. In today's world, where that works wonderfully for a studio film, but not as much for independent films or smaller projects, how can you apply The Writer's Journey into a niche? So, like you were saying, I want to see myself in it. So, in my book, I talk about the power of the niche. And let's say, instead of making a romantic comedy, so which is just about generally two people, like the general feeling of falling in love or not, losing love, all that stuff. I say use the vegan, make a vegan chef romantic comedy where a vegan chef falls in love with a barbecue pit champion. Mm-hmm. And now we can target that movie to a much more powerful, deep and focused audience as an independent filmmaker can, as opposed to abroad, because as abroad, I can't as a filmmaker, an independent filmmaker with a $3-5 million budget, unless I have some major stars, and even the major stars is going to be very difficult. So as a storytelling element, how can you apply The Writer's Journey into more of a niche model? And do you suggest do you agree with what I just said?
Yeah, I do. I think that that's actually a growth area, carving off maybe increasingly smaller slices of life. And, I think always continuing to lift the cover off things and look deeper into corners of society we haven't looked at before. So that itself has a value. But then there is the general human condition, and that's where the general and these hero's journey things do come into play, because as different as people are, they are driven by the same list of drives and needs, no matter what their conditions are. So there's a pleasure I think the audience has in going, I'm going to educate myself about a new walk of life I don't know anything about. We're watching Ricky Gervais's show. I think it's called Second Life. Mm-hmm. Where he is a guy whose wife has died, and he basically is suicidal. But he just says, I'm going to do whatever I want because what difference does it make? And we're watching on two levels. One is the general problem of anybody losing someone they love. And then on the specifics, he's opening the door into this little town in England that has all these different levels of society that you get to see. And it's so enlightening. I just feel educated in a painless way about the way other people live. This is a lot of the appeal of literature throughout time. Of course, it's that it gives you that vicarious experience of somebody else. Well, it's still comforting because the basics are still there.
So I want to talk a little bit about the concept of the niche and kind of starting to go a little bit deeper in that world, because when you do when you're a writer, you have an audience you're trying to go after, generally speaking. So even Star Wars is going after a sci-fi audience. It did grow out of that and turned into a broad market. Like, everybody watched Star Wars at the time it came out. Obviously, if Star Wars shows up today, it wouldn't even see the light of day, really. No one would really care because Star Wars already presented its that whole introduction into the world. It's definitely a movie of its time. Its time and its place, and that's why it exploded the way it did. But moving forward as a writer, as a screenwriter, the different genres that you write, focusing on a niche that eventually has those common elements, like my romantic comedy. There's love, lost love, you know, Romeo and Juliet, all of that stuff. But with the way the world is going, which now is becoming much more curated, where before it wasn't curated. Like HBO was HBO. But now HBO has a flavor to it. Disney Plus has a flavor to it. Hulu has a flavor to it. And before, all these companies were trying to maybe even be more broad for everybody. But now they're just like, that's not where the money is. The money is less specialized in this world. So as writers, as screenwriters, again, I think we're saying the same thing. Working within the more curated niche worlds, but keep those elements that are universal in there. But if you're focusing as a writer on a universal broad topic, it's going to be a difficult sell. Would you agree?
Yes. Yeah. I think things have to be specific. You know, this is something I've confronted a lot because I work sometimes in very abstract thought forms and think about, you know, a big epic subject, for example, or a fantasy, but it doesn't really land either to sell it or to present it to an audience until you've narrowed it down to. This takes place in Chattanooga, Mississippi in 1952, you know, and you have to anchor it in something real to get that double resonance of the big general thing and then the specific thing. So, I think there's nothing new about this development, which is very interesting what you've said about how these producers of content are developing personalities. And there's, as I say, nothing new about that because this happened early in the studio phase.
Yeah, Warner Brothers films, Disney films.
Warner Brothers was distinct, you know, and down to detail, like the gunshots in a Warner Brothers film sound different. And you can spot a Warner's film from the 30s, 40s, 50s because they were using the same gunshots, the same pieces of tape. And, you know, it was distinct and they were appealing to people who liked bubbly musicals and gritty stories
gangster.
About crime in the streets
gangster.
And that sort of thing. And then they got into, okay, Errol Flynn, and we could do these swashbucklers. They developed that whole site, and then other studios were doing other things. So, and I've always loved that. I've always loved the fact that the companies I worked for had personalities, and it paid to know the personality of your studio, what was possible at Disney, what had been before at Disney, and what could be again. This was part of sort of the institutional knowledge that I tried to encourage. I sort of held myself up as a champion of the personality of the whatever studio I was working for, and I try to find opportunities to feed that in working at Fox or Paramount or whatever. I was always a curator in a way, looking to find where that heartbeat was and to feed it with, you know, more of that kind of content or expand on something.
It's really interesting how the business is changing so dramatically now, and that curation aspect of storytelling is a survival mechanism, I think, because mm-hmm. I mean, did you just read that article that came out that Disney's reorganizing their entire company to focus on streaming?
Oh, like, no. Well, yes, actually, I do know what you're talking about.
I mean, that was a
buzz in the last couple of days that okay, we're going to turn like that.
That's a huge, that's a bomb going off in our business because Disney is essentially the biggest studio in town. And for them to say, you know, the theatrical thing is not where it's at. we're going to start moving towards streaming. And it makes all the sense in the world. And I agreed, we're getting a little off topic, but generally speaking, it was going to happen. We all knew this is where it's going to go. It's just that COVID really amped everything up and sped everything up.
That's right. It was that odd accelerant that, like I say, about developing this way of communicating was something that was there and not appreciated for its value until we really needed it. And then all of a sudden, oh, I'm so grateful that we already had Zoom and all these other things. I think same thing here, that people have been talking about all these evolutions, but it wasn't necessary. Now the trigger's here and people are going with it. I wonder what will happen in the long run about, I don't think going to movies, even going to drive-ins, has come back a little bit. I don't think that's going to die, but it's not. We're going to go back to a normal, but it won't be the same normal. It'll be a new normal, just like with COVID. And there will be experiences where you go to a theater, but it'll be different somehow.
And I'll end this conversation, this topic, because I could talk for about another hour just on this. But I agree with you 100%. I don't think that movies will ever go away. The theatrical experience will never go away, just like Broadway is taking over plays. I mean, it won't go away. I think it will be a different experience. I think that it will never get back to 2019 levels, just on a screens level and on people going to the movies again. It's going to take a while for this hangover, the COVID hangover, as I call it, because people are just – you're used to not going into a crowded room anymore. So it's going to take a minute for your mind to kind of wrap yourself around going back to the theaters and doing all of that. But also the screens are going to be less. Regal just shut down. I promise you, Amazon is probably going to buy AMC or Regal. All these big streamers are going to buy these theatrical components and then start doing them in a completely different way. Because if you own the theater and you own the content, well, that's a different business model than just selling popcorn. So, and this is all for screenwriters and for storytellers to understand what you're doing as a storyteller. You need to understand where your movie, your script is going to go. If you don't think about the audience, if you don't think about who are you trying to sell this to at every level, from the point where you write the script, am I selling this to a producer? Am I trying to sell it to a studio? Am I trying to sell it to an independent filmmaker? Like and then from there going, okay, now who is the audience for this film? And I think that's where so many screenwriters fail, is because they just write because I'm good at write. But unlike a novel, which you could just put out because you just wanted to write, a screenplay is that blueprint that could be millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars, blueprint. So there's a lot of pressure on that art. And if you don't really think it through, you're not going to make it. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, I'm really big on this idea of having the audience, whether it be an agent or the producer or the actor or the audience itself, having that in mind and opening up a conversation with them, I think, is very important. It just makes me think about a time when, you know, before I got to film school, I was in the Air Force and I made documentary films about the space program and so forth. And I wrote a script one time and I showed it to one of the old editors, and he said, well, you've got some good information here, but you have to remember one thing. You've got to make it so simple that even the general can understand it.
That's great.
So, you know, I knew I had to adjust to the ultimate audience for this, which was going to be some general in the Pentagon. And I had to make it clear enough so it was communicating with him. You know, I'm very strong on that you really have to cultivate this sense. And I've always thought of myself as an evaluator of material, as, you know, I'm a specialist and I've had my training and background and all of that. But basically, I'm just a moviegoer. And I think the way most audience members do. I know what I want to see and don't want to see. And I've trusted that.
Now, there's a section in your book I'd love to talk to you about, because I'm not sure if it's new or if it was in the last edition or not, but can we discuss the rules of polarity?
Yes, this is in the earlier editions as well. Okay. You know, this is a thing that became obvious to me in the very first week I started reading scripts for the studios. They operate on a sink or swim basis, and they just hand you, once they've read a sample of your work, they say, okay, I think you can do this. Here's seven scripts. Come back on Friday and give us the reports. And I noticed right away on the first two or three scripts that they were polarized, that every universe that the film writer was creating was divided into two camps. It would be the men and the women in a romantic comedy. It would be the upper levels of society and the lower levels, or the cops and the robbers, or the Indians and the cavalry, or some other oppositional frame would be created. And then it became a dynamic process where it seemed the filmmaker was presenting you with, like a court case, with, okay, here's the arguments for, here's the arguments against. And then that somehow invites the audience to take a side or to evaluate, like an undecided voter, you know, like, I'll listen to all those arguments, I'll listen to all those arguments, and then I'll make up my mind. And it seemed that it was an engine that drove the story forward, that the opposition of those two polarized forces really got the story rolling and created this kind of tension and made it have a heartbeat, like a tick-tock. And then I started thinking about more specific rules. And this was a little later as I worked at Disney, and especially as we were getting scripts intended for animation, where they would take an old fairy tale and try to, like Rumpelstiltskin or something, and turn it into a feature-length 90-minute or so screenplay. I started seeing that there were some rules about the polarity. And also this comes from observing especially the buddy comedies that we were doing a lot of at Disney on the live action side at that time. This was in the 80s and 90s. And those operated on a strict polarity. There would be one style of living of a cop from Detroit who was of the streets. I'm talking about Beverly Hills Cop.
Yeah.
And he was rough and tumble and almost a criminal himself and irreverent. And then he'd be clashed together with somebody who was the opposite, who was by the book, strict, buttoned down, just as different as possible. So those two things clashing together made an interesting dynamic, a lot of conflict and opportunity for comedy. But also there was a mechanism in it that I detected, which is that at some point – the poles would switch, and the person who was wild and crazy would be forced to put on a disguise and look like he was buttoned down and clerical and, you know, more West Point. Mm-hmm. And then the other guy who was by the book would be forced to change clothes and be in the wild position. And they would experiment with that for a while, but then come back again to their comfort zones. It's like, well, that's your basic nature. You're a wild man and you're a button-down guy, but you've had a visit to the other side, and you aren't going to land right back where you started. You're going to come out somewhere a little closer to the middle, not smack in the middle because that would be paralyzing, but a little closer to your opposite, so that you can experiment with it, you can take advantage of some of the good things about that other way of living, and yet you're still close to your comfort zone, and if you get scared, you can run back there. So it served as a model, and then I found it validated by things that were happening in my own life, in the relationships of men and women, marriages and things like that. I saw these same forces at work. So I tried in the chapter to think almost like I was dealing with some force of nature like magnetism or something, that magnetism has some rules and polarity is like that. You turn one of the magnets so that they're both negative poles, they're going to fly apart. You turn it the other way so it's negative to positive, they're stuck together. And polarity in stories can work that way too. People seem to hate each other at first, and then something shifts and now they're wildly attractive.
Yeah,
and
so
they fly apart again, but they come back together.
Yeah, so like The Bodyguard with Whitney Houston and Kevin Costner's characters, that was a perfect example of them hating or not wanting to be with each other, then eventually coming together. I remember Stir Crazy with Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor, 48 Hours, Lethal Weapon. All of those have everything you're talking about.
Yeah, and it's funny because just mentioning the titles and this idea, it comes into your mind right away, and you can see the two sides, even on the poster sometimes, they're looking at each other nose to nose, you know, and just as different and contrasting by casting, if nothing else, they carefully choose who's going to embody these opposites. And that's automatically attractive. That's one of the rules of polarity, is that if you put up two things that are the same, that has very little value in attracting the eye. But if you put something just in a piece of art, in a drawing, if there's a heavily shaded area and then one little area of light, you're attracted to that and you are interested in the contrast. So
So if Lethal Weapon was two white guys, it wouldn't be nearly – on a visual standpoint as opposed to Danny Glover and Mel Gibson.
Yeah.
I remember the poet because I worked at the video store. So I remember that cover so clearly. It just grabs your eye. Or 48 Hours, Eddie Murphy and Nick Nolte, like two complete opposite looking gentlemen bring you, and they were also dressed differently, and one's like, you know, funny, and the other one was like, you know, like you said, almost literally he was a prisoner. He was literally a criminal. Yeah. And mean teamed up with a no-nonsense, not straight by the book, but just like a no-nonsense cop.
Who hated, no bullshit.
That hated criminals. I mean, right. It's brilliant, but you're absolutely right. The more contrast you can create in the characters visually as well as thematically, it's more interesting of a story. If it would have been two criminals in 48 Hours, If it would have been two Nick Nolte's, Like imagine if there were Danny Glover was suicidal as well as Mel Gibson in Lethal Weapon 1. If they were both crazy men, nobody wants to see that. It's like, well, they're just going to die.
Well, this is actually what happens in this dynamic I'm talking about, is that naturally suicidal one, or the one who was suicidal to begin with, is shown in contrast. But then maybe the other one develops, the one who's all, hey, peppy for life and don't kill yourself, it's crazy. Mm-hmm. Suddenly something happens and now they're both standing on the same base and that's crowded. So that might make the one who was originally suicidal have to go to the other side and try and talk the other guy out of it and say, you know, I know I want to kill myself and I've made a good case for it, but you can't kill yourself. So, you know, it allows that movement. It's like a sort of sliding scale, and you want to slide back and forth a number of times.
I remember that, and a story by everyone listening, spoiler alert on Lethal Weapon. Sorry, after 20 odd years or 40 years or whatever it was since it came out, 30 or some years, whatever. But I remember the end was so specifically because obviously, Riggs had no problem killing people. Like, he killed people left and right. And Glover was like, why are you killing everybody? Stop killing everybody. And the last fight with Gary Busey in the lawn, he has the moment where he's about to kill. He was about to kill Gary Busey, and he decided to let go and not. So the Riggs at the beginning of the movie would have killed him in a heartbeat, but he decided not to do it and let him go because – Danny Glover's character, Murtaugh, infected him with this. Like, he pulled him closer to where he was. And then there's other scenes in the movie where Murtaugh definitely starts moving towards the crazy man that Riggs is the movie. And then at the end, you know, obviously, you know, Gary Busey decides to go up and they both shoot him and they both kill him, which is like both of them literally coming together to I don't know what the term would be not rationalize, but actualize their characters finally. And at the end, they're both a lot different, but yet they're still – Riggs is not Murdoch or Murdoch's not Riggs, but they're definitely closer to each other than they were before.
This brings up a larger point, which is, you know, the question of what do people want from entertainment? They want to be taken, obviously, out of themselves. They want to go to a different world. They want to experience some other life vicariously. And people will say, don't lecture to me. Don't give me a moral. I don't want that. I'll make up my own mind and so forth. And I think that's absolutely wrong. I think people want moral essays. They want prescriptions about how to live better. They want examples, and they want to see people learning. And this is all kind of subterranean. Their first thought is, okay, show me some explosions, car crashes, sex, the interesting stuff. But so I say they come in for all that stuff, but they stay for the learning, for the lesson, for this thing that sticks with you afterwards, where you take, maybe it's just for a fleeting second, but you take a look at your own life and you say, you know, I've been a little bit too much of this or too much of that, and I need to shift a little bit. This is one of the beautiful things about this work we do, is that you can't really change people 180 degrees, but you can shift them, shift their consciousness a little bit, and that's fantastic. That's incredibly powerful to make sometimes these little increments of awareness that's really deep, actually.
Now, there's a chapter in the book I'm dying to ask you about, the vibes chapter, and mm-hmm. talking about chakras and how to use that concept in your storytelling. So can you please explain a little bit about vibes, the chakra element, and how you apply it to storytelling?
Yes, this is a new chapter for the 25th anniversary edition. It's kind of the meat of what makes it new. And this is the result of several years of traveling around and sort of shyly, tentatively bringing out this side of me, which is I grew up in the Midwest in the St. Louis area on a farm, but I came out to California in 1971 and I ate it up. I mean, I landed in the middle of the hippie era, and that was just great for me. And I absorbed a lot of ideas. And that was one of them, that we live in a universe of vibrations. And we talked about it. You know, we had the Beach Boys song, Good Vibrations. And we'd say, you know, did you feel the vibes in that room last night? And, oh, my God, I got such a bad vibe from that guy at the meeting. And, you know, we had this idea that everything we touch and feel and see and hear is vibration. You can hear my voice right now because I'm vibrating a column of air in my throat in this room that's making this element in the speaker go and the mic go back and forth and so on, transmitted down to the vibes in your ear. So everything's vibration. And this also came from, you know, I went on a course of study of spiritual things and the occult and, you know, mysterious mystery religions and all that sort of stuff in my 20s. And I studied the chakra system, which is this idea from India, basically.
It's thousands of years old. You know,
it's
years old.
Very, very old thing that even, you know, is probably well understood before anybody discovered how to write. But the idea is that up and down your spine, you have different spiritual centers, and they're pictured as lotus blossoms that are either just, you know, an imaginary form, but imagined as flower blossoms that are either open or closed. And as you develop spiritually, you open higher and higher centers until, you know, theoretically everything is open and then you're Buddha. Most people only experience a couple of those things being sort of turned on or open at any particular time. But how this all came together was that when I worked for the studios, I went up a ladder and got away from the doggy door part of my career, where I actually was now going to the meetings. This was at Fox, on my second term at Fox. I was part of the team that decides on Monday morning, we talk about the scripts we read over the weekend, and we argue and defend or attack everybody's projects. And if three people say, I think it was good, it gets bought and it gets made. So those are very, very important meetings. And I noticed most other people were commenting on the scripts in a kind of a numerical way by saying, well, we think it hits this demographic and it's probably going to hit 30% of the male audience. And, you know, they had it sort of rigged almost mathematically. And I didn't do anything but point to different parts of my body. I said it got me, it choked me up and it made my heart race, or it tightened me up in the guts. And then I just lifted the top of my head off in the last act. So I realized, I put it together, I'm pointing to the chakras. And I began thinking about these as potential targets for your emotional effects, so that because I think everything is or should be intentional in this business. You should lay down an intention, and maybe the audience interprets in their own way and they go off your intention. But, you know, you really need to be thoughtful and conscious and intentional. And so why not study the different areas of the body and think, I want this to reach out from the page, from the screen, and hit them right in the gut. And I want them to be thinking about their guts right now. Or I want them to feel protective of their heart at this moment, or just feel a stab when somebody betrays someone on the screen. Or there's wonderful moments in movies like in The King's Speech, where he struggles to speak and he's got all the heart in the world and he loves his people, but he can't get it out through the throat chakra. And eventually he does make the breakthrough. And it's such a big moment everybody loves that, that kind of scene where somebody speaks their truth and is able to hook up one or more. And that was another aspect of it, is that I realized the good scripts that I was describing on Monday morning were hitting at least two of these centers and creating a kind of a circuit between them. So the heart and the throat, were connected. Mm-hmm. Or people say about Hitler, he was very open in the power chakra down in the guts. He was closed tight in the heart chakra, had no compassion for other people, but he was very open and powerful in the throat. So he hooked up the power from his guts and used it as a microphone through his throat and was able to, you know, move the nation. So these connections of one or more centers are, I think, necessary to, whether you're aware of it or not, this is what you're doing, is you're triggering reactions in different places in the body. And it's good.
So is there any character in movie history that connected more than four or more of those chakras, or God forbid, all of the chakras were opened up in the course of that story, or hit all of those energy points?
Yeah, I think so. I think, first of all, in religious areas, Buddha, Jesus, et cetera, have hit most of those marks. But it comes up in films every now and then. There was one little film that I kind of cherish called Phenomenon with...
I love it. Yeah, with John Travolta. Yeah. I love that movie. It's
an absolutely ordinary guy, kind of down to earth, even a little selfish and unaware. And then something happened to him. I forget what the trigger was.
It was a light from the sky came and hit him and gave him these phenomenal. If I remember, it was his mind. He just became insanely smart. But he also had powers, some sort of telekinesis of some sort.
He was like an angel. There was another film he did called Michael. I think.
Yeah.
It was an angel, but he had these kind of unusual powers. And I remember a couple of things, although my memory is very dim about most of it, a couple of things stuck with me. And one was that moment when he received this information, and it was done so simply and elegantly, and yet it touched those chakras, which was, they simply panned up to a tree, and you saw, maybe a little slow motion, the leaves of the tree were rattling and reflecting, like my hands are doing now, a little bit of light, dark, light, dark. And that is intensely stimulating to the eye, the whole chain of to the brain from the eye. But it just said, without anybody saying anything, God is present in this scene, and you know, or some otherworldly force, because they didn't name it. And it transformed him. And then he was operating as a fully realized human being. And all those things were open and functioning for him.
You're absolutely right. Yeah. His character became almost, you know, godlike or guru like on earth. He was essentially walking, you know, the Christ consciousness path, the Buddha consciousness path. Yes. I haven't seen that movie since it came out. I gotta go back and revisit that movie, because I remember loving that. Was the same year of Good Will Hunting, and that whole, I think Titanic 97, if I remember correctly. It was a great film. I wanted to ask you, can you apply the hero's journey into arguably the most profitable place for a screenwriter to be in, which is television? How do you apply the hero's journey in a series, in a season, in a complete series? How does it do it? I always like using Breaking Bad as an example, because I consider it one of the best television shows ever created. But what would you do? How do you do it?
Well, I think this is where an awareness comes in, that the hero's journey somehow operates what I would say holographically. And what I'm referring to is when you make a hologram of something, you can say you've taken a picture of a penny, and you load that somehow onto a piece of glass, and with a laser light shining through it, if you turn it around, you see the backside. It's just a piece of glass, but you turn it around, you can see the backside of the penny, and that's remarkable enough. But they say if you smash that glass, the image of the penny is there in every little piece of it. And so that's one of the qualities, weird qualities of a hologram. And so it is something that seems to operate at every level of magnification. So an individual shot can express a hero's journey element or the whole hero's journey. Somebody fighting a dragon, just that's all you need to see, and you kind of can infer all the rest of it. It operates at all those levels, all the way up to the arc of the entire series, where somebody's soul is at stake, as it was in Breaking Bad, or their way of life is at stake, as it was in Downton Abbey. Where, you know, this question hangs over every episode. And this is the real answer here, is that it's a series of questions of different sizes. And there's one giant question mark over the whole thing. Is Tony Soprano going to live or die?
Right.
Is Walter in Breaking Bad going to survive or be redeemed or whatever happens to him? And then in the individual seasons of, let's say, a 5-year show, sometimes I've noticed they will carve out a certain aspect of the hero or the hero's world and say, okay, for this season, we're going to look at the family dynamic. And the next season, we're going to look at building the business. And the next season, we're going to look at competitors coming in and messing up our plans. And that over 5 seasons can be a hero's journey. And you can plot where the highs and the lows would be, and so on, down to the level of the individual episode. There's a question mark over every episode, and then there are sub-questions in every scene. I've looked a little bit in this respect at Downton Abbey. Downton Abbey starts with a telegram that says, somebody has died on the Titanic, and now the place is up for grabs, basically, and it could go any way. And meanwhile, there's a servant arriving whose little question mark is, will they accept him, even though he's lame from the war? He's got a war injury, and he can't be as effective. So you're looking at the big picture. Will the whole thing fall apart? Will the beautiful princess get married? And maybe that takes a whole season to develop. Will the servant be allowed to stay despite his infirmity? And so on, down to the individual scene. Will the master overhear something, or will the person who has the information betray somebody else? So you're working basically with a sliding scale of questions.
When you just said, will the princess get married by the end of the season, or whatever that is, it brought back two shows that played with will they ever sleep together concept, which drives a lot of shows. Moonlighting, which was Bruce Willis's big thing with Sybil Shepherd, they were just like, will they, won't they? Will they, won't they? Will they, won't they? Will they, won't they? They hate each other, but they want to get together. Will they hate it? And when they finally got together, the entire show cratered. It just cratered, and it never recovered. Then you got a show like Friends, which had Ross and Rachel, which was another will they ever get together? Will they ever? And they held that on for like two or three seasons. They held till finally they get together. And that's death a lot of times, because that's why you're watching. You're like, okay, fine, they got together. Now where do you go from this? Well, then you rip them apart. and then you're constantly ripping. And then that relationship becomes so much more complicated over the course of whatever, 10 years that they did that show. Till finally, you know, again, spoiler alert, they finally end up together at the end, because that's the only place they could end up. But they were able to keep that going for such a long time. So that is a very powerful tool to throw that question over a series. So I think it's something that that screenwriters should really think about when constructing story and constructing a series and applying that little tool is so powerful. Like, will Tony Soprano live? Will Walter White survive? You know, will Downton Abbey, like, will we lose our way of life? It's such a powerful thing.
And then, you know, episode or season by season, they'll look at the sub questions, like, will his marriage survive in either case? Will their relationship with their kids go south? Will the competition come in? Will they be undermined by some mistake that they've made? That's a very strong and kind of almost Shakespearean thing that was operative in The Sopranos, that he tripped over some moral tripwires. And then you were in suspense. Is this going to come and get him eventually? So I enjoy watching those, watching the question as it unfolds. People will ask me, where's the best place for the love scene or the sex scene? And there are several answers. I can say, get them together in bed or kissing before they go into the big ordeal in the middle, roughly. That's one way, because then they go in together. They're joined. Or you have the intimacy in the actual ordeal in the middle, in the difficult test. They're grabbing each other, maybe that's the test, is can they get together and survive that? Or after, just after, is another nice place, because we've been through something dangerous together, and so it's natural to hug each other and become intimate. But the very best place is after the story is over. That's when you want to let the audience imagine what it's like for them to get in bed together, because the audience is better at constructing sex scenes than the best screenwriter in the world. Their imaginations do a fine job.
Yes, and Hitchcock knew that.
For them,
Hitchcock knew that very well. With don't show the murder, listen to it behind a closed door, and that's much more terrifying.
And don't answer every question, because that makes room for the audience to participate. I think that's a basic distinction you can make about Hollywood versus independent or European style. Hollywood is a little more parental and cut and dried. And so we're going to resolve every plot and answer every question. And there are many more question marks at the end of an independent or basically European story. They don't sit in God's chair, and they're more speaking adult to adult, and leave room for the audience. You know, Hitchcock doesn't answer everything. One of my favorite of his films is notorious. And there's a mystery in it from the beginning, which is Cary Grant is weirdly nervous about intimacy. And he's got this beautiful woman, Ingrid Bergman, right in his lap, but he can't pull the trigger. And he's, you know, hesitant about it because he's torn with his duties. And you wonder, why is he so weird about women? And first of all, it's Hitchcock. But
also, yeah, there's that.
Also, there's room for you to enter in, which I did. And I made up my own backstory for him that he was weird about women because he was in love with a spy during the war. She betrayed him. He had to kill her. And now he doesn't trust love anymore because he figures eventually they're going to betray me. So and that's not in the script, but it's in my, you know, expanded version in my mind. And I think that's great. You want the audience to do some of that work for you. So, you know, a wonderful thing, even on the microscopic level of scenes and dialogue, there's a wonderful thing you can do where somebody says, he's talking about his mother. They're meeting for the first time, getting to know each other. He talks about his mother. And the girl says, I noticed you don't talk about your father. And the guy doesn't answer. He changes the subject. So, wow, big arrow points at the relationship with the father is really screwed up somehow. So that's probably going to pay off later, or it means something. And that's one example of how you can invite the audience to participate. Just and an answer to the question.
And my last main question, I know so many screenwriters who think that the hero's journey is a very dated concept and that everybody knows about it and all the audience knows about it already, and it really doesn't apply in today's world. Does the hero's journey have a place in modern storytelling?
Yeah, I of course, I'm going to say that it does. That's what this model is based on that. But I do believe it because I think the audience is programmed that way and they actually like it and enjoy it. When they see it, they feel ownership, they feel possession of it. And I think that it's extremely difficult for a filmmaker to tell a story that doesn't touch a corner of it somewhere because it's as prevalent as air or color. You know, like I'm going to make a painting that doesn't have any colors in it. Or I'm going to make a composition without any sound, you know, no notes, you know, and that's how essential these things are. Even, you know, you can make a composition where all the notes are sour or where all the notes don't make sense or they don't have a sense of rhythm. And that would be maybe an interesting composition, but it's still using the notes. You really can't escape these things. It's a frame. And the only thing you can do is say, I'm out of that frame, but you're still saying there's a frame. And, you know, you can judge me by how far I distance myself from it, but I'm still stuck dealing with that frame. Very hard to escape.
Now, I'm going to ask you a few questions to ask all my guests. What are three screenplays that every screenwriter should read?
Ah, yes. Very interesting. First thing that comes to mind is the script for Risky Business,
yeah,
which was Tom Cruise, one of the pictures that put him on the map. That's a script I read at the studio, and I wrote the shortest response I'd ever written. Just buy it, do it, make it. It's near perfect. Don't mess with it. Don't screw around with this. Just make that script. It was a near perfect screenplay. I think along those lines, let's see. Gosh, I'm stumped on other great screenplays that I've read. I think The Shape of Water, which I wrote about in my book, mm-hmm. would be an interesting one to look at from the point of view of how do you put in the fanciful things and the fairy tale things. It has wonderful eccentric dialogue. That's one of the beauties of that script. And I don't know, cause I haven't looked at the screenplay per se, but I suspect it was written in. There's a kind of a halting, I don't know, what's a, it? I've always tried, you know, this kind of erratic rhythm that is in Richard Jenkins' dialogue particularly. He's the friend of the girl who takes on the monster. And I appreciate that very much. And then I'd go back and look at, which I did, look at some Hitchcock. Look at the script for Notorious and see how economical they were and how they wove things into the thread. It's a tapestry. And what I mean is that Hitchcock would use dialogue as music, and he would introduce themes through his screenwriters. Like if you look at, if you did just a word search on Notorious, you would find the word trust comes up probably more often than a lot of other nouns that have to do with feelings. You won't hear much about love, but trust comes up often. So I think looking at classics is probably the best avenue.
What advice would you give a screenwriter wanting to break into the business today?
Well, again, read a lot of screenplays, and you no substitute at all for just general reading and knowledge. That was sort of my calling card that at the studios, was that I had broad general knowledge because I was interested in a lot of things. And, you know, in your career, almost anything is going to come your way, and you have to become almost an instant expert on everything. Reading and you know, for me, I sort of take the pulse of the world every day by reading the New York Times and the LA Times and looking at Facebook, and up from that comes some kind of picture of where the consciousness of the world is going at that time, and then that feeds back into my writing sometimes. So just being well informed.
And what is the lesson that took you? And what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
Let's see. I think it's a personal thing that I am probably my own worst enemy, and I set my own limitations, and largely they're baloney creations of my own mind, and it's really Mr. Fear talking. It took me a long time to learn that fear was actually an ally if it's acknowledged. If you realize I'm not going where I want to go, I'm not getting where I want to go. Why is that? Oh, it's funny, Mr. Fear. I know him. I've dealt with him before. So I just have to go, hello, Mr. Fear. I acknowledge you're there. I know you're there trying to protect me from being hurt, but I'm okay. So step aside, buddy, and let me go ahead and take the plunge. So it took me a long time to figure out that fear was both an enemy and an ally.
And where can people find the new book and more about the work that you do?
Well, the greatest sources for that, I think, would be Michael Wiese Productions, which is MWP.com. They have the full list of books, not just mine, but a really good library of all kinds of books about filmmaking, independent filmmaking, and then Amazon. I also have a WordPress blog, which is Chris Vogler's Writer's Journey. Those are the best sources, I think. For hunting me down.
Chris, thank you so much. This has been such an enlightening conversation, and I just love talking to you because you're such a wealth of information. So thank you so much for writing this book 25 years ago and now giving us an updated version for today's world. I really appreciate what you do and the work that you do. And thank you again for being on the show, my friend. It's been my honor.
Hey, and thank you very much. Your questions are great, and I love the work you're doing. So keep it up.
I want to thank Chris for coming on the show and dropping the monomyth knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thank you so much, Chris. If you want to get links to anything we talked about in this episode, including his amazing book and his course, The Screenwriting and Story Blueprint, The Hero's Two Journeys, which is, of course, available on indiefilmhustle.tv. Head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/091. Thank you so much for listening, guys. I hope this episode was of value to you on your screenwriting journey. As always, keep on writing, no matter what. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.